for me, it was pure adrenaline. I was shaking because it's finally here and I've been waiting so long to go to this island, and it felt unreal, actually.
For me, very, very similar.
Welcome to the Birding Life Podcast, Africa's number one birding podcast. I'm your host, Adam. This episode is without a doubt one of my personal favorites of the season. Recorded on board the Flock to Marion cruise, I had the incredible opportunity to speak with two field researchers, Danielle Keyes and Leandre Debier, women who've spent months living and working on Marion Island, one of the most remote and wild places on Earth. They share what life is like on the island, from preparing for a 30-month stay to navigating extreme weather, and the highs and lows of field research in such an isolated environment. But more than that, they offer an honest and heartbreaking look at the devastating impact invasive mice are having on Marion seabirds, and why this matters. Their first-hand experiences bring to life the urgent need for the Mouse from Marion Project, one of the most important island restoration projects in the world today. This is a cause that needs your support, not just for the birds, but for the sake of preserving one of the last truly wild places for future generations. You'll find a link in the show notes to donate and be part of this critical conservation effort. So grab a coffee, sit back, and let's head to one of the wildest corners of the Southern Ocean with Danielle and Leandre. So firstly, tell us a little bit about the history of Marion Island.
Yes, so Marion Island is part of an island group called the Prince Edward Islands, which is the Prince Edward Island and Marion Island, and South Africa annexed these islands in 1949. So we've had a permanent presence on the islands for many years now. We've started with a weather base or weather station on this island. And more recently, we've been doing long-term monitoring on multiple different seabirds, seals, and other cetaceans around the island. This place is an incredibly harsh environment, to say the least. It's found within a belt known as the Roaring Forties, where you quite often have these incredibly strong winds that blow through the area, and it really shapes the landscape in Marion Island.
So you spoke about the research that's done on the island. So tell us a little bit about the research team that is based on the island. As far as I remember correctly, you are based on the island for about a year or so.
Yes, for about 13 months.
So it must be amazing being on the island with this incredible mix of people. You've obviously got your area of expertise, but you've got all these other people who have also got other area of expertise, and there must be so much learning that takes place over the year.
So you get two types of positions, a base personnel and the scientific field assistants. And usually the base personnel, they stay on the base, and that's a medic, diesel engineer, communications engineer, diesel mechanic.
You got some weather guys as well, South African weather personnel, and also SANSA. So those are the space guys who look at the stars, and they're incredibly smart. So it's lovely to work with them.
And sometimes you get a chef as well.
If you're lucky.
If you're lucky. And then we have, depends on the project, there's birders, botanists, sealers, a killer whaler, entomologists, and then environmental control officers.
Yeah. And a geomorphologist. Yeah. They also look at the rocks.
So we mentioned earlier that you're on the island for 13 months. That's a long time to go. And there's not just a spa down the road or a pick and pay or something. You've literally got to pack everything that you need for the year. So let's talk about, what do you pack for a year on Marion Island?
Wow. Well, we can explain two different ways here. So we've got two different experiences of here. I can explain a more standard way, and Leandre can describe a very special cruise, which was a lot more difficult, I think, to pack. So generally, when you go to Marion Island, there's really no limit to what you can pack. So you pack all your hobbies if you're into painting or reading books or music. You'll take your instruments as well. You can bring as many clothes as you want. I even brought a duvet, high luxury. I brought way too much alcohol. I do appreciate a glass of wine, especially after a really long cold day. So you have to try get enough alcohol, which it really shocks people. Myself and my husband went down and we had to go into Tops and imagine buying a year's supply of alcohol for two people. People think you want to start something illegal. So you do get some funny looks. And you end up packing way too many toiletries, I guess, because you fear that you're going to run out. And in some years, we were incredibly lucky, like Liesl Pessois. She actually got us some sponsors for biodegradable products. So you can try and get your team to get some of that. So we had tons of drums of these products. And yeah, so there's really no weight limit generally to what you can bring. And family is also really lovely. They can sometimes give you little care packages. So they can write little monthly inspirational notes and give you a little bit of your favorite trinkets from home, which is really special.
It's also, it's difficult to plan ahead because you really don't know how much toothpaste you use in a year. And I ended up, I think, having to bring back six boxes of toothpaste. And you can actually taste that it's old now.
So just a quick question. You know, you're on this island for a long time. I mean, there must be something that you crave when you're there. I mean, maybe it's Mackey D's or a chocolate or something. What is that item that you crave that you cannot wait to taste again?
Yo, I can promise you it was not fast food. It was something fresh with a crunch.
Tomatoes.
I actually despise tomatoes, but for me it was an orange. And I definitely cried when I got back on board on the SA Agulhas and had my first orange. It was very embarrassing. So
usually fresh fruits and vegetables.
Yeah.
Because after a year on Marion, you're just so tired of frozen veg.
Yeah,
chips and
potato wedges. You don't want to see a pilchard or a potato wedge for the rest of your life. So most of the food that we get is canned or frozen. So if it can be canned or frozen, it's there. Except frozen fruit, that would have been lovely. but none of that. So you have even pasta in cans, which I don't really quite understand why, but it's there. So
you're going away for a long time. I mean, there must be some serious training that goes into preparing you to go away for this year, not just the preparation and the training in terms of the work you're going to do, but also I can imagine there's psychological training, you know, being away in isolation, away from your family. What does that training look like? What do you cover when they go through that training?
In normal years, you usually have fire marshal training, first aid training. You have a session with a pastor, I remember. There's also like orientation sessions with the Department of Forestry, Fisheries and the Environment because they manage the island.
And first aid, I don't know if you mentioned that. And you also have rope access training.
Yes.
And many of us are obviously selected because we are specialists in our field. So you all have individual-based training. And that's also you learn how to make food, which is really great. Even though sometimes it feels a little bit useless in a way because they give you fresh products, but meanwhile all you have is cans and frozen goods. So you have to start getting really creative when you try and make your food. It really is. Like, we had some of our best times in the kitchen, even though it might not always have tasted the best. Yeah. It was really fun being in the kitchen with the team. And then when you get onto the island, there's a month where you train in your specific field. So you'll have your supervisors and the previous members of the Marion group that will train you for the year ahead and teach you where to walk, how to behave around particular animals, because it can be really dangerous, especially around the seals and cliffs. So they give you all the required training that you need.
So what were some of the meals you ate on the island? You know, what were some of the highlights? and what were some of the lowlights? I hope that the person who maybe made the meals that were the lowlights are not listening to this here.
Lowlights is here, I'll tell you about it.
Fish and chips. You get tired of fish and chips.
Yeah, so many fish and chips.
Probably some of the best meals were made in the hut. It's like we made some cakes and we made hut burgers. You can make pizzas. You can have my worst meal was 2 minute noodles and canned Viennas and some canned peas. That was terrible.
and obviously you're not always used to making food for a large number of people, like 12 in our year, or normally you have 22 people, and sometimes you just have this large quantity of food being made. So I remember one teammate made lentils because we had a lot of vegetarians, so he thought he'd make lentils, and I swear there was enough for a week. So we were eating lentils until it came out of our ears. But we were particularly lucky our one teammate really loved making pastries and cookies, and oh my word, did we eat well. He went and sorted the mixed nuts so that he could separate the almonds and all the other nuts. To make, what's it, biscotti?
Yeah.
Oh my word, that was such a treat. And he made all these little delicacies for us. And we had someone else who would make us fresh bread. Coming home to fresh bread was, I know it sounds like something so simple, but fresh bread was one of the big highlights there.
Yeah.
So we went down to Marion on a cruise ship. I don't think the researchers get to go down on a cruise ship. So how are the researchers transported to the island?
Well, typically you go on South Africa's pride and joy, the SA Agulhas 2. It's an incredibly large icebreaker. It's beautiful. It's really stable through crazy storms. It's absolutely lovely. You get served 3-course meals on this boat. There's a gym, there's a sauna, everything you could imagine. So essentially like this cruise ship, but without the windows. So it's really lovely.
Yeah.
But it's not always the case.
Well, and they use this cruise ship, the SA Agulhas, to find Ernest Shackleton's endurance ship as well.
So yeah, in Antarctica.
Quite an impressive ship. Definitely made for science. But in my year, both Danny and I went on a very small high latitude expedition yacht that can take about 12 people. But we were too many people for the ship, so we had to share bunks. And then be on watch. We had to help with the sail, and it took a lot longer for us to get there. Usually with the SA Agulhas, it's like 3 to 4 days, and this took 8 days.
And
it was quite an experience, but we also saw a lot of nice, rare marine animals. The first albatross.
Oh, such a wonderful sight. Yeah, that was quite an experience and a half. We all have different memories of it. Most of mine was hanging off the side of the ship, feeding fish. But yeah, it was really quite an experience. Here we see the waves and they look quite small when you're looking at the top of your deck from the cruise ship. But we at one stage went through a storm force 11 and it only goes up to 12. So you can imagine like riding these massive waves going down, and this yacht would bend 90 degrees into the water. You'd have cups flying everywhere, and none of us are really experienced sailors, and we learned on hand, which was really great. But our captain was absolutely phenomenal. At no point did he seem stressed at all. I think maybe I just couldn't read his face. And we didn't shower, so when we met the people on land, don't think they were too thrilled to see us.
But we were thrilled to see
them. Yeah, yeah.
So I want to ask you, what did it feel like when you first got to Marion? I mean, you've done all these months of training. There's been this preparation that has gone into it. There's been the anticipation, and now you arrive at Marion. What emotions went through you? You know, we got the opportunity to look at Marion from a distance. You got the opportunity to step onto Marion. What did that feel like?
For me, it was pure adrenaline. I was shaking because it's finally here, and I've been waiting so long to go to this island, and it felt unreal, actually.
Yeah. for me, very, very similar. The first time, so I've been on two expeditions, and the first time I got there, I didn't really have that wow moment because you're incredibly rushed. You have to go straight into training. Like I got there next day, I had to go on a round island, and we have a very, very tight schedule. And it was only after everyone had left, after when we were truly alone, a little team of, I think it was 22, that you could be like, wow, I'm on this incredibly beautiful island all on my own, and I now have this opportunity to start working and exploring. And then that was when it really hit me. And when for the second time, when I got off the yacht, I was just so happy to just be on land and to be alive.
Just when we landed on the island after this yacht expedition, we got an email saying that we had a 50% chance of survival because all of the others, half of the other yachts have rolled over when they were trying to get to Narian Island. Yeah. So a lot of people back home were very scared to tell us to go on this yacht.
Yeah. And we were obviously way too naive, too excited to go to this island because obviously you're not going to give up this opportunity to go. So we just went freely. I think in this case, it was in our favor that we were a little bit naive.
Yeah.
So you're on the island, and a lot of the time that you spent on the island was at the research base. So tell us about the research base. What was it like being based there, and what were some of the amenities that were at the research base?
So it's quite a big base. It looks like something from a sci-fi movie. I'll start with probably one of the most important rooms for South Africans is there's a braai room. You've got a good view of the north part of the island. There's a big bar area, TV room, like a games room where there's ping pong tables, pool tables. There's a big TV room where you can watch movies at night. So there's a lot of entertainment. And then there's a big industrial kitchen, which is quite intimidating when you have to cook for a team of 20 people. And then there's a dining hall where you can eat dinners together. And then from there, you have the science offices, labs, and the storage rooms. So each project has their own office where you do your work, plan ahead for your days out. And then there's a communications room, and this guy controls the Wi-Fi, can talk to field assistants in the huts.
He found out that apparently you can SMS people between the huts, which was great news because often the signal is quite bad. So he's quite an essential part
smart.
Of our personnel, or whoever it is, he or she.
And then each team member gets their own room, and you decorate it to make you feel at home. There's also a few other like dry rooms where you leave your clothing, your wet weather gear, your mud boots, so that you don't get dirt into the rest of the base.
Or the smell.
Because we all have to clean the base, which is quite hard work as well. It's quite an impressive base. And there's actually enough space for about 70 people when it's the takeover period. But you usually get your own room, and there's enough bathrooms for everyone. Yeah. There's actually a gym and a sauna, which I didn't mention.
I was impressed. We used it quite a lot in our year. Not a gym, but we stretched quite a lot. I felt very proud of ourselves, especially after doing all your exercise outside.
Yeah.
And there are obviously the lab space. So each research unit has a office, and you have a wet lab and a dry lab. So stinky stuff stays in the wet lab, and there's obviously storage room for all of those, and massive storage unit for food as well, which is very important.
Like a Pick n Pay hyper where you can just go and get food.
Yeah. It's actually great. Rows and rows of food.
Yeah.
As always, the Birding Life is proud to be associated with Swarovski Optic, one of the world's leading producers of binoculars, monoculars, and spotting scopes, as well as the Birdlasser bird logging app, Spot, Plot, Play a Part. Download and install the app to play your part in social conservation. One of the ways that you can help us to keep putting out the content that we are releasing is by supporting our online shop. We sell optics, books, Westermann's products, and a whole lot more. Check out the shop on our website, www.thebirdinglife.com. If you need any help with any of the products, please don't hesitate to email us on info@thebirdinglife.com. So what was the Wi-Fi like out there? I mean, you don't have fiber on the island. What was the Wi-Fi like?
Yeah, no, it's not great, but you can at least make WhatsApp calls and send messages on WhatsApp. But you have to set up your email in a basic format so that you can send emails. It's very difficult to upload or download attachments. And then it also depends on how many people are on base, how good the Wi-Fi is. But if you have to make an important transaction or send an important attachment, you have to ask the comms guy to put off the Wi-Fi for everyone else. And that usually happens only at midnight. So you have to wait for that to make that transaction or that email.
Yeah. Yeah, you learn a lot of patience because as anyone has had a call on WhatsApp, you're so excited to tell them a story and we're talking and then they're slow and then you want to say something and then there's a lag and then you just get lost in translation a lot of the time. So you learn to slow down. 5,000 knots. Oh, no, no.
So we've been out on the deck and we've seen how people are dressed really warm. I mean, gloves, beanies, jackets and all that kind of thing. So let's talk about the time on the island. I mean, it must be incredibly cold. How do you dress when you have to go out and work on the island?
Well, it depends on what season it is. In winter, it's often very, very snowy, cold wind. You have hailstorms coming through. So then you'll layer up quite a lot. You'll have a pair of thermals, 2 to 3 layers of socks. and you've got your trusty steel-tip gumboots, which seem to be the only thing that survives in this type of environment. Initially, it takes a while to walk these boots in. A lot of us end up having blisters all over our feet for the first month, few months until they harden up a little bit. And you have your blues, which is almost like a denim pants.
Overall
pants, yeah. And then a fleecy jersey that you always have with you and your Gore-Tex over that. So that's winter, a little bit different in summer.
In summer, it's usually, if there's sun, you can just wear your thermals and a short top. But yeah, you have to know that the sun's very harsh on Marion. I know someone who burnt blisters because they didn't wear their thermal tops. So
yeah.
You always wear a hat, you always put on sunscreen.
Even though it's in such a cold environment, you forget that the solar radiation is actually really harsh there. My husband's bald, so he managed to experience that firsthand. Also burnt his head quite badly. So always remember your hands and your face because those tend to be the only parts that are exposed. You get used to the weather on Marion, even though it's really cold. But after spending a really long time there, 5 degrees doesn't feel as bad as the first time, which is very strange.
And I forgot to mention, but you always take extra warm weather gear with, because like in my year, my hands freaked out. I had like 3 pairs of gloves with me every time, because if one gets wet, you have to put on a new one. And fingerless gloves works well because you have to work with them. But sometimes people put on those thick fleece gloves as well when you're walking.
Yeah, but then your fingers are quite dumb, so you have to sacrifice warmth for dexterity. And you always bring like an extra pair of clothes in case there's a river that you don't really manage to cross entirely.
So we've spoken about how you dress, but you obviously go out onto the field work and you've got a backpack on with a whole lot of supplies. What do you take when you go out and do the field work?
It depends on the type of research that you're doing, but I'm sure Leandre can start on that one.
Yeah, so usually you take a waterproof notebook, a pencil to write in your observations. For me, I had to take like equipment like tools and spanners, take your binoculars, or when you're a sealer, you take those applicators to tag animals. And then, the birders, like Danny, would take just her binoculars.
It wasn't just my work. It depends on the work you do. If you're tracking birds, or if you're about to deploy a GPS or a tracking device, you would have an ice cream tub full of little devices. Now, even though they're light, they gain some weight as you go along, and then have all the tools you need to stick it onto the birds. Bringing pliers are quite common. to have with you so that you can ring the birds on the island. And also snacks. These are important. These are your little snacks and water. Yeah, definitely. And I often say I'm a sucker for punishment. In my first year, we were still allowed to bring alcohol. And I would usually, if I went to a hut, I would take myself some wine, which was lovely to have after a long day of work at a hut. So
as you go around the island and you do your work, there's all these little field huts that you stay on when you're doing your research that out in the field. What are these field huts like, and what type of thing is in these field huts?
It's much better than being at base for us personally.
Absolutely.
It's quiet. You just hear the burrowing birds at night. You can see stars. The huts usually have a food store where all the dried foods are kept. And then there's the actual hut, which has four beds and a kitchen space where you can make food. There's a communications system where you can talk to base. And there's also a dry room with a heater where you can heat up, put all your wet gear in there to dry up for the next day. And you know, at night, there's no light, so you only burn candles, and you probably go to sleep at like 8 already.
Because
when it's dark, you go to bed.
Yeah, when you're away from technology, you tend to not do that. So you spend a lot of time reading books, and luckily a lot of people brought books to each of the huts underneath these little chairs. There's stacks of books, and then you have a hut book as well, which is really fun because where people... It's supposed to be there to write an entry of where you're going, but often people will write stories or adventures or poems even. So it's really fun to read those.
And on the island, what is the kind of work that you do on the island? How does that look?
Oh, well, that's a fun one. We both had very, very different roles. Do you want to go first?
I was a winder / botanist on the expedition that I went on. And so I had to install, maintain, and download data from wind stations all around the island. I also helped with a lot of the time-lapse cameras on one part of the island where we see birds crash. And then I did some genetic sampling of plants. And I just took every opportunity I could to help other field workers as well. I did some insect work, some bird work, some seal work.
Yeah, I can attest to that. Leandri is one of the best field assistants you can have. She's got such an incredible memory. It was always great to have her by your side helping you out in the field. So I'm a birder. Also jumped onto many projects where you can because it's fun to be able to see different sections. But my work predominantly worked on maintaining long-term monitoring colonies. So essentially what you do is you ring the birds within a demarcated area and you check on them to see if they have an egg, the egg is hatched, and whether or not the chick has survived until the end of the breeding season. Another aspect of my work, which I thoroughly enjoy, is telemetry work. So this is where we use GPS devices, which are very similar to the ones that are on your phone. And we put these onto the bird's back. They're super lightweight, so it doesn't hinder their flight. And we're able to track their movement at sea, which is absolutely incredible to know where these animals are going. And because they come to land to breed and they've got a high sight fidelity, which means they return to the same place, we're able to recapture them and retrieve the device and get the data. And this is really incredible data we can obtain, and it's important for spatial management to highlight areas in the ocean that are important to marine life. So other thing that birders, we do a lot of counting. A lot of counting. So we'll walk around the island counting all the rock hoppers and the mackies and the gentoos and or really anything that moves on the island. If it moves, we'll count it. And if we're not going to count it, we'll tag it.
So last question. You've been on the island. You've spent more than a year experiencing what Marion is like, and you've seen the devastation that is happening as a result of the mice up close. So why do you feel that people should get behind? Why should people support the Mouse Free Marion Project? Tell us in your words.
Hey, I'm going to do my best not to cry because it's really hard to see this island and know what it could be in such a pristine state but have this effect on the mice. So I'm going to tell you the whole story essentially. So when I got there, you hear of the story of the scalping. You hear of these terrible zombie mice, and you're like, oh, you know, it can't really be that bad. And you get there and you start noticing, oh, they're mice at base, and it's really annoying. And these mice are in your bedrooms, and you have to keep them out of your stash, which is not great because you don't have shops, so you can't get them out of your, you need to get them out of your food supply really quickly. And when you walk outside, especially at night, you just see them all over the place. I did a lot of work on burrowing petrels. So when I'd walk around at night, you just see them all over the paths, and they just go in and out of the nests, which is really concerning. And you obviously try and catch them or trap them in some way, but they're just so many.
Mm. And so quick.
And so fast as well. It's really hard to catch them. And still at this point, I was like, oh, shame, mouse. And then I started doing work on the sooty albatross. And this is where I saw my own scalping firsthand. And to see this chick with its head absolutely bare and not being able to do anything. Like, I've been bitten by these animals and it hurts. But for some reason, they just don't, well, because they're such naive animals and they're not afraid of these mice or don't know that they should be, they just don't do anything. So they end up being eaten alive. So it's really heartbreaking to see. And then you get to the wandering albatrosses and you see that their nests are just filled with these little holes that the mice have made, and it destroys the integrity of the nests, which is really heartbreaking. So we know that Marion's getting quite dry at the moment, and when the rains do come, the nests tend to break. And then you'll have the chick that falls to the side of the nest. And what happens is the adults, for some reason, they just stop feeding their chick then.
They're not on the nest.
Yeah, when they're not on the nest. And they just let their chick starve, or it gets eaten by another predator. So even when these mice aren't having a direct effect, they still like hinder them. So, you know, I think Marion Island is such an incredibly wild and actually near pristine place. And we don't have so many places like this left in the world. And I think we really owe it to these animals to give them a chance. So part of my research was looking and trying to understand how these animals respond to climate variability and how they behave at sea, and to see if they're doing okay. And the adults are doing fine. They're doing, especially now for the wandering albatross, they're managed in the Indian Ocean sector. South Georgia is not some different story entirely, but the animals are really doing great. They are so dynamic and able to respond to the changes in their environment. But now these, this new threat, these mice, they don't know what to do about it. And we've recently had wandering albatross adults being eaten by mice. And this is incredibly concerning because they've eaten the easy prey. They've finished off the seeds and the insects and the burrowing petrels. And now they're going onto these bigger birds. And because the environment is a lot drier, they now then go out of their burrows and they don't have these mass die-offs, so their densities are increasing, so it's becoming more of a problem. So yeah, it's really, really heartbreaking to see. And I think
it's something, you know, we can fix.
Yeah, that's the
biggest
thing.
We've seen success stories.
Yeah, that, like, you know, so many islands have had these eradications, and if the animals are being given a chance, they come back, they bounce back. So and I think that's the best part of it. It's like, even though it seems dire now, I think if we take action, we'll really see a positive change. Thank you.
Thank
you so much. It's been lovely.
Thank you so much for taking the time to listen to this week's show. We really appreciate your support. If you have any comments or feedback on any of the episodes, feel free to drop us an email on info@thebirdinglife.com or send us a message on any of our social media platforms. We would love to get to know you better. So, until next time, be blessed and happy birding.